Your attention, please. The lid is on. Thank you and good night. Fighting ain't no use, old
gun. Stand together as one. Hello and welcome to The Lid Is On, our podcast series from UN Radio in New York. I'm Jocelyn Sambira.
My name is Whoopi Goldberg, and I'm thrilled to be back at the United Nations for yet another historic high-level meeting, this time on ending AIDS once and for all.
History is in the making here at the United Nations, where people from all corners of the earth have gathered to seal a deal to end AIDS as a public health threat by 2030. Discovered in the early 80s, by the year 2000, it had become the fourth biggest cause of death worldwide and number one killer in Africa. Since the beginning of the epidemic, 35 million have died from AIDS-related causes. Today, more than 30 million people around the world are living with HIV. On the other hand, the progress made has been tremendous. 17 million people are on treatment today. New HIV infections have fallen by 35% since 2000, and AIDS-related deaths by 41%. Passion, dedication, commitment, and lots of money. That is what it has taken to get these results. Some have spent more than 30 years of their lives fighting stigma, getting life-saving medication to people who need them, saving lives and raising money for a cure. In this podcast, you'll get to hear their stories, starting with the American fashion designer and activist, Kenneth Cole.
More people have been put into treatment in this last year than have, in fact, contracted the virus. But if, in fact, there isn't a continuation of this initiative, we will see that reverse. Rather than see an end of AIDS by 2030, we could see AIDS back to its historical level of devastation.
A true Brooklynite, from the early 1980s when AIDS became a crisis in New York, Cole used his brand to raise awareness on issues like homelessness and HIV and AIDS. He often uses a play on words or puns in his ads to provoke and spark debates. His first campaign in 1985, a photograph of top models with their kids taken by the leading New York-based portrait photographer Annie Leibovitz with the message, "For the future of our children, support AIDS research," reached 1 billion people. Kenneth Cole joined AMFAR, the Foundation of AIDS Research, shortly after and became their chairman in 2005.
We are living in a global community today. Everything is connected. If we're not infected, we are affected.
The AIDS pandemic still kills millions of people every year. I think about 1 in 25 of all the deaths that occur in the world are due to HIV or AIDS.
AIDS is not an American problem. It's a global problem.
And he has just been named United Nations International Goodwill Ambassador for the UN lead agency in charge of the global HIV-AIDS response, UNAIDS. Here's the head of the agency, Michel Sidibé, making the announcement to the press while the cameras flashed. He describes Cole as a people person and shares the reasons behind his decision to appoint him.
We need different constituencies with us. We need people like you, people who have been able from the beginning to believe that we should fight against exclusion. He's a very successful fashion designer and businessman. And I personally feel that he could have been just saying to himself, I don't need to be in. He just decided to just say to himself that no point to have all of that if millions of people without voice are suffering.
I spoke to Kenneth Cole in a comfortable lounge at the UN Secretariat with a view overlooking the East River. He's soft-spoken and listens intently when asked a question. What was it like in the 80s when the HIV/AIDS virus broke out, and how has it evolved today?
It was very scary in 1985 because we knew very little. We didn't understand it. Early on, we knew how to contain it. We knew how it was transmitted. We didn't know how to cure it. Not that different 30 years later, by the way, but we're much closer today than we were then. So it's not as scary because we know how to protect ourselves, unlike Ebola and Zika. And so we know how to keep ourselves safe if we choose to. Many choose not to, or many choose to be oblivious to it. And we've learned today that many, you can live on medication a relatively healthy life today. But there are so many people still contracting the virus. And last year, 2 million people contracted HIV and 2 million died, according to UN statistics. So it's still a devastating global pandemic. And I think we all look forward to that time when it isn't.
Can you share with us a story that's stuck with you in the years that you've been advocating for a cure?
So many stories. Well, very early on, from 1985 or 6, I had an associate of mine, David Brignoli, and David had visual signs of the virus. And I asked him if he'd been tested, and he said, no, why should I? And to what end? The implication being is that he would be ostracized. David died 6 months later.
Is it something that, moving forward, inspired you to sort of help others?
Yeah, no, I think that to the degree you can inform people, you can help them, give them the power to make informed life choices and decisions, and they will usually make the right ones.
Can you tell us what motivated you to partner with the UN?
I think we're at a pivotal time. And as chairman of AMFAR, we're very focused on a functional cure by 2020. The UN is focused on ending AIDS as a public health crisis by 2030. It became apparent to me that we are in effect interdependent, and that the UN can't really achieve its goal unless we first achieve ours. And then I also wondered how many other organizations we could possibly align with and fold under our umbrella, the same shared umbrella, and create a coalition and an initiative that's unprecedented and probably could never have been done before because of social media, because of shared information. And so I think this is a pivotal time. Plus, we're at a moment now where, as is announced at the high-level meeting, more people have been put under treatment in this last year than have, in fact, contracted the virus. So we're going to see a turn statistically. But if, in fact, there isn't a continuation of this initiative and of this energy and resources, we will see that reverse. And we could potentially, rather than see an end of AIDS by 2030, we could see AIDS back to its historical level of devastation, which makes it very compelling. And it makes it an extraordinary opportunity and a privilege for me to be afforded a role in this process.
You're seen as a pioneer here in America and in New York as a pioneer in terms of the fight against HIV and AIDS. And you've used your skill as a strategist, using messaging and using your company as a platform to spread the message and raise social awareness. You've done it also for AMFAR. Is that kind of along the lines you're thinking of when it comes to your role as a goodwill ambassador?
My hope is that if I can align everybody's interests, then it becomes very easy. You know, as you do what you do in the ordinary course, everything is served. And I think that is the case here. I think ANFAR's needs get addressed to the degree we're able to move their agenda forward. We are simultaneously moving UNAIDS's agenda forward. And to the degree I can professionally provide for my needs, then I'm able to do everything else. So I do believe there's a lot of synergy. I've learned how to do that over the years. And I'm looking forward to finding ways that I can be effective. And I know that's not always easy.
You have a project that you're working on in Asia called Treat, and you're also thinking of expanding it to other areas. As an international goodwill ambassador, are you thinking of also creating a synergy between these projects and what you're going to do?
Treat Asia is networking these various providers of services, of HIV-related services, throughout Asia, networking with them with each other, sharing data, sharing information, sharing medical resources, intellectual resources, financial resources. So that's an AMFAR initiative, okay? What that represents, I think, is significant because I do believe the UN has broader reach than AMFAR does. If it has the will and the focus and the resources, I believe it can do a lot.
On a more personal level, what actually made you commit so much to the cause?
You know, I guess initially because I could. And I've lost some people in my life to AIDS. I think we all have. And but I think it's just what it signifies. And I do believe that as we make an impact here, it's going to have an impact on all infectious diseases. It's an impact on humanity. And I think we're going to see the public health spectrum move significantly. You know, and then if you look at it from the scope of the UN, human rights related, there's people that have just not been afforded the privilege and the access to treatments that everybody else has. And there's no reason that needs to be. I do what I do, I guess, because I can.
When you first started the initiative in 1985, there was a lot of stigma attached to HIV and AIDS. Wasn't it taking a huge risk actually associating your company with a disease like that?
I think that because I wasn't in one of the high-risk groups, maybe I wasn't as concerned as others were, and apparently because others were reluctant to come forward. And I felt I could appear to be maybe more objective, and I could appear to have a more credible voice. I wasn't a sick person crying out for help. I was a very relatable person trying to bring a spotlight to a very critical need. And that's what I set out to do in 1985, and today I've reached and accessed greater resources and to an even greater need. And today it magnifies significantly.
You've created some very bold campaigns and ads. One of, I think, the most provocative is the We All Have AIDS. Can you tell us the story behind that?
You know, the goal was how do we marry all these extraordinary AIDS activists, and how do we all come together with a shared sense of purpose without a sense of competing for resources? And the one element of this crisis that few really knew how to address was stigma. So, and that's what this campaign stood to do, was to hopefully erase stigma to some degree and get everybody to agree to hold hands, appear together behind one lens in one place and time.
How did you convince everyone to be part of it? It must not have been easy.
I think people respected the campaign, and many knew the one we had done prior with Annie Leibovitz, and they respected the peers that were going to be part of it, and they were happy to be part of this ambitious goal, and they didn't have to do much. And I think it's kind of set the stage for hopefully what we can now do to an even greater degree.
Apparently that campaign reached 1 billion people. Throughout your campaign or your support for fighting HIV and AIDS, messaging has been very important. Is it something that came to you in the course of your work?
We sat down creatively and came up with the method, the message, and then it evolved. It took on a life of its own. You know, and then times have changed. You know, there used to be, I think it was believed, we were all 6 degrees of separation from everybody on this planet. Today they say there's 4. Today, if you have the right message and you have the right messengers, you can connect with everybody on this planet, I believe, in a day or in a few days. So the ability to connect and to inform is so unprecedented and it's so powerful.
One of the messages that you often give is what you stand for is more important than what you stand in. Where did you get that from? Who inspired you to live your life that way?
A lot of this is just lessons I've learned along the way. I have found that I have been very fortunate, and the more I'm able to do, the more I've grown, and the more I've learned, and the more I've gotten back.
Looking at the numbers, thinking that, you know, we're still in 2016, there is no cure. Other times you felt like this was a hopeless cause?
Yeah, there were times, especially early on, and I worked close with Dr. Krim, and I'd get a wake-up call from her periodically, just, let's have lunch. And I'd kind of get re-energized because she never lost her enthusiasm. But yeah, it's very easy to become fatigued. So for years and years and years, you read about people dying. You don't get a sense that there's light at the end of this very long tunnel. But today you do. And that tunnel isn't so long.
Having helped raise money for the research, do you feel that we are closer to a cure?
I think we're closer to a cure. But, you know, when AMFAR is focused on a cure by 2020, we're raising a lot of money and we're spending a lot of money on cure-based initiatives. And there was initially some reluctance. Well, what if we don't get there? And I says, well, we'll be a whole lot closer because we try to. A, we believe we can, and I believe we will. But even if we don't, there is no question that we need to bring to bear all of our resources to try to get there. So that's what we're doing.
I've been wearing the HIV positive t-shirt for 13 years. Whenever I wear it, it isn't a fashion statement. It's actually about to bring the visibility of the issue forward.
That's Annie Lennox, UNAIDS International Goodwill Ambassador. According to UNAIDS Chief Michel Sidibe, when choosing his goodwill ambassadors, he looks for compassion and commitment. Annie Lennox is not lacking in either. She delivered the closing speech at the UN high-level event on AIDS, presenting a new campaign called Born Free.
I've been wearing the HIV positive t-shirt for 13 years. It's been a very helpful tool. It's not my invention. I copied Zaki Ahmad, who at the time was the most exemplary leader from Treatment Action Campaign. Zaki himself was HIV positive and he refused to take treatment until it became affordable to every citizen in South Africa. So he really risked his life for the cause. So this t-shirt that I wear that says HIV positive works in different ways because the virus is something invisible. And the stigma creates an invisibility as well. So whenever I wear it, it isn't a fashion statement. It's actually about to bring the visibility of the issue forward. Whenever anybody takes my photograph, I don't care that they're taking a picture of me. I want them to look at the issue. And that has been a really, really helpful tool, and I'm really, really proud to wear it.
When you were invited by Nelson Mandela to South Africa in 2003 to participate in an event, you were very moved by some of the words he said, calling this epidemic a genocide. Do you remember that moment?
Completely. I will never forget the moment. It is absolutely marked in my psyche. We were standing in Robben Island in the former exercise yard. Nelson Mandela was giving a speech in front of his former prison cell, and the international media were there. And he said, there is a genocide taking place in my country, and the face of it are women and children. And I say to myself, why didn't I know this? Why didn't I know this? Why doesn't the world know this? They still refer to the AIDS pandemic as something that happened in the 80s that was affecting LGBT population, intravenous drug users, sex workers, all true. But where was the representation? Where was the voice for millions of women and children? It was never represented very well. So as a woman and as a mother, no matter what color my skin, I felt I have a platform now. I can really possibly contribute and use the platform as a communicator that I have to try to amplify the voice and become an advocate and campaigner for this issue.
Are you happy about the progress that's been realized in terms of women getting more and more access to treatment?
We have seen tremendous improvement there. I mean, really off the chart. I think it's 84% women on treatment. Babies do not need to be born with the virus. That's the very first sort of sacred moment of life, a child being delivered into the world. What could be more precious than that?
Do you believe that we can end this epidemic in our generation?
I think we absolutely can, but we must have the investment, we must have the political will, and last but not least, eventually we must have a vaccine.
Oh, motherland Africa, let us fight the
AIDS was a death sentence when I was growing up in the African nation of Burundi. I would see posters plastered around the town with drawings of people on their deathbed, rib cages protruding with a chilling message, AIDS kills. Imagine being 12 and finding out that not only do you carry the HIV virus that could progress to AIDS, but also TB or tuberculosis. Lois Matuta of Zimbabwe had just lost her mom and her brother to the disease when she was told about her status. Years later, she's alive and well. She's happy and full of life. Antiretroviral drugs have helped her lead a somewhat normal life. In turn, she's dedicated her life to coaching other young teens and adults dealing with the same situation. It's hard to imagine she once tried to end her life. Here's Lois.
Knowing about my HIV status, it was one of the most depressing moments for me, and it pained my heart so much. I lost all my confidence that I had, and I thought I was going to die. That was the end of me, because my mother and my younger brother had all passed away in the same week due to HIV and tuberculosis. And in 2002, by that time, I was 10 years old. So it was really a depressing moment for me.
Growing up, what was your interaction with your friends, schoolmates?
There's this silent stigma, which is not like direct, especially when I stayed with one of my family members. I went through emotional abuse, I went through physical abuse, shouting at me, saying, do you think you're special? If you want to die, just die. It's not me who made you to become HIV positive. Go and cry at your mother's grave. you know, saying such kind of things, and people within the next door could actually hear what he would say, and everyone at the end of the day got to know that Lois is HIV positive. So hearing such kind of words in my life, and at that time I was still at school, I tried killing myself by taking all of the medication that I had. And I said, I am so sick and tired of this situation that I have. And I said, I just want to die. I cannot contain this. I just need to die. So I was admitted to the clinic, to the hospital. And after I got discharged, I got massive counseling from the organization that I'm working with back in Zimbabwe. And they counseled me after I got discharged. And I said to myself, if I'm to live again, I want to make sure that I share my story and breaking the silence.
A lot of people feel that this generation is ignoring the epidemic, and that could be a problem in trying to get rid of it.
I can say to a greater extent it's very true. This is because of stigma and how HIV was introduced when it came. Because HIV was introduced as a disease that a person contracts after having so many sexual encounters, but people not really understanding that a person can be born with HIV and then contract it through using sharp objects, those kind of different things. So back in Zimbabwe, I always talk with a group of children who are in schools, and their greatest issues that they say about HIV is that I fear to know that I have HIV. And there was a study that was done in Zimbabwe, and it shows that adolescents and young people are not scared of HIV, but they are scared of getting pregnant, because pregnancy, a person can easily see it and people can talk about it, than when you're HIV positive. You can just secretly take your pills and no one will know.
There's no cure for HIV and AIDS. The UN is looking to end AIDS as a public health threat by 2030. Kenneth Cole is fighting together with AMFAR for a functional cure by 2020. The UN says the next 5 years are critical. Without sufficient and sustainable funding, the gains made so far risk being lost, and the AIDS epidemic will rebound with tragic consequences. Jocelyn Sambira, United Nations.
AIDS is a killer.
Yes, it's a killer.
AIDS is a killer.
Oh yes, it's a killer.
AIDS is a killer.
Yes, it's a killer.